Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hey, everyone. Thanks again, as always, for joining us here today. Today, we're going to be interviewing Changrai Li, talking about his new book, My Year Abroad, which was published last week by Riverhead. And all of you obviously are familiar with Changrai. In fact, there's someone at the bookstore who wanted to start a Changrai book club. I said, well, it only lasts 5 months, but now it can last another month. So in any event, and those five books would be Native Speaker, Just Your Life, Aloft, The Surrendered, and On Such a Full Sea. His new novel is, as I said, My Year Abroad. And the problem I have as a bookseller and doing the show for 600 authors is when you read a really good book that's 500 pages long, it's kind of irritating because you're going to read it in one sitting or one laying, which means you'll finish at 4 o'clock in the morning, which screws up your next day. So it's like a mixed blessing. And also when you read a really good book that's 500 pages long, that's filled with food and drink, you get really hungry and really thirsty. And then you make yourself either mozzarella sticks or you're going to make yourself codfish ceviche, which I'm not going to do. So it was basically, I did make an omelet is what I did. So anyway, before we begin, I just want to just go, this is what I do. I'll let Changrai talk in a minute. When I began this book, I thought, okay, our protagonist, our hero is Tiller in this picaresque kind of novel. And I thought, oh, so he's going to steer the whole novel. And then I realized, no, a tiller doesn't steer a boat. Somebody steers using the tiller.
Yes.
My girlfriend told me this, and I was thinking, yeah, I was going to come in here saying, yeah, so Tiller is the guy who runs the whole book. And in actuality, that's not the case at all. So rather than me rambling, maybe you could take off from there.
Yeah, I'm glad you noticed that. People always ask me about, where does this Tiller come from? You know, and obviously it's tongue in cheek, but it's straight on too, which is he's looking for a way to be guided through the world. You know, he's supposed to be at the tiller but in fact, he's the thing by which a kind of pawn in certain senses, a kind of puppet in others, But he's embarked kind of, you know, idly and not really thinking too much on this exploration of his realm. But he doesn't know how big the realm is. He has no idea what it holds for him. He's just trusting this other fellow, whom he sees as a mentor, this Chinese businessman named Pang. And hoping, I guess, that, it'll be interesting enough, like any 20-year-old kid might do when presented with the idea, would you like to join me in this, cross-Pacific trek, as I would have when I was 20 years old. I would have jumped at it. But of course, I would have jumped at it blind and ignorant, which is a lot what Tiller does. And I had a lot of fun putting myself back into my 20-year-old self, thinking about that.
That's exactly what I did. And I was thinking, okay, so when I was 20, would I have done this? And I go, yeah, I didn't have any plan at all. So if anyone suggested anything, that seemed okay to me. So just do it. But, and you know what? Like my dad always said, no matter what happens, it's not the end of the world and things will always turn out okay. Yeah. So far, it's worked.
Most of the time, that's the case. Most of the time, that's the case. And we laugh about it, but sometimes it isn't the case, right?
Correct.
Accidents happen. And sometimes people are maybe more malign than not. And you get into their crosshairs intentionally or not.
Yeah. If you talk about bad things happening, there are, I mean, if you talk about just the concept of parents for both, Pang, for Tiller, the losses that they've had have really affected their lives tremendously, right? And bring a lot to the book.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I wanted to make sure that this was not just a picaresque tale in the present with a lot of event and situation, and that would be, you know, fun and flagrant and outlandish and bizarre. I wanted all those things to happen in terms of the happenings. But for me, the most interesting part is, why are these people on this quest, right? And what have they endured? What's all the stuff that they've been carrying around that they haven't wanted to explore, and that they maybe never will, short of, you know, being forced to? And in a way, you know, the story is a way to put pressure on them, and to, particularly on Tiller, and also Pong too, to do a little reckoning when of course reckoning, as we all know, is kind of the hardest thing to do.
There are so many things that are, you know what, it's what makes it easy for an interview is always, and I'll look at it right now, is when, well, first of all, the cover is really cool. And second of all, and you know, I own a bookstore. So as many times as people say, don't judge a book by its cover, pretty much every single person who's ever walked into my bookstore judges every book by its cover.
It's true. I love this cover because when I first saw it, I don't know, you can tell me what you think, but it looks so, to me, so much like a WPA era work in a funny way. And so it had an antique feel to it, but like an antique feel thinking about the future. And it's very colorful, and it has nothing to do with the book in, you know, in literally, but somehow it gets the feeling of things piling on one another, a lot of color. So it's a kind of strange, perfect cover for me.
Isn't it funny? You just described yourself. You described kind of an antique feel, but looking toward the future, you know, like your books. It's like this, everyone always asking you about futuristic stuff. And that's what you kind of just talked about, actually. So what about the, all right, so the reason I was going to talk about the epigraphs, the thing about epigraphs is I always like asking about them because I know the author, like any reader, good reader would, must have thought a long time about the epigraphs, because it's like the cover of a jigsaw puzzle. You know, there's the picture and inside are all the pieces.
Yeah. And the epigraphs, for me, they came early. I mean, you know, these are books that I was, you know, that I've loved over the years. And but there are three, you know, one from Malamud about heroes. And that for me was one of the, you know, important notions of the book is that we need heroes. And particularly this young kid, Tiller, needs a hero. He needs a mentor, a guide, someone to model himself after. Not to model himself exactly, but to try to understand, you know, how can I be in any way special in the world? Maybe he can show me, because he's a kid and person who doesn't feel very special, and can maybe light the path for, you know, where I'm going to go. And that's why we have mentors, heroes, big brothers and sisters. And then the other one, there are two others, one from Mon, which is, that, if you truly love the world, you shape yourself to please it. And that's an interesting idea. When I read that, I thought that's a great line, because it says something about how the world is, that in fact, we can't change the world. The world will proceed. It'll have its traumas and delights, regardless of who we are. And if you truly love the world, truly love this life, you'll in some ways recognize that and understand that you know we're subject to it, and to really go along with it, enjoy it, and to take full advantage of it. We can't tilt against the world, because of course we're so small and flawed.
Yeah, and the funny thing about it is the epigraph's almost like a template. You could kind of lay it over more than one character in this book, you know?
Absolutely. And this book is definitely about, you know, about ambition and striving, but the limits of all that, right? In particular, say in the Pong story, where his father particularly was a lauded artist during the Cultural Revolution. But because of one strange painting of Mao, and the way that the political environment was and the philosophical environment of the time, that he becomes crushed, as he says, dirt on the heel of a shoe, just by circumstance. And that is something that's quite scary, I think, to us in the world. And I think, gosh, what we're seeing now through this pandemic. I mean, you know, think about all the people whose livelihoods, say, running a restaurant, you know, being an airline attendant, a flight attendant, where things were just doing really well. And through no fault of your own, this one virus pops up.
All the stuff in the book resonates so much with what's happening. You know, you look at that painting of Mao, which is a great, the way you describe the different paintings and what does just tip them over on that painting is amazing. But then you think about today and this concept of deep fake and, you know, making a fake speech by Pelosi or something like that. It's so much easier today. And then you talk about a failing restaurant today, but you also, your whole, the whole story of Punks talks about failing restaurants and what the consequences of those are. Okay, sorry. So the last epigraph, go ahead, sorry.
And the last one is from Lao Tzu is, music in the soul can be heard by the universe. And again, when I read that, I, you know, there, this is why we read, of course, because you read lines like this and you, and they'll stick with you forever. And not, you know, not necessarily in like, oh yeah, I know exactly what that means. Sometimes it's just, oh gosh, that there's a feeling there that is so profound and so deep. I don't know exactly all the ways in which that makes sense, but
yeah.
But if, but for this book, I felt as if Tiller particularly has a kind of music that has not yet been played inside. We all have this internal music, and I think, you know, it's, it, this is a very hopeful quote that it is heard by the universe, but sometimes our music is not heard by everyone else in the universe. And we want it to be. It's an idea that we do have something rapturous and glorious and really beautiful and full of glory in us. It's just sometimes so damn hard to get it out and to find it.
Yeah, it's so funny because there's so many motive forces in this book, whether it's drum or Lucky, for example. You could almost say the book pivots on Lucky, but, you know, and then DJ and all that. But when I read the last epigraph, reread it after finishing the book, I realized that music in the soul, to me, that was drum, simply because there was this deep understanding and comprehension. And I don't want to get into any spoilers, and I won't. But there was just something about him that last epigraph resonated with me. Oh. Do you want to hear a, I'll give you an epigraph for your next book, but then you got to figure out what the book is about. Right. Okay, listen to this. It is the height of bad manners to mention a rope in the house of a hanged man.
That's a good one. Well, but we all have those ropes, obviously. You know, that's, well, this is my dark consciousness. The thinking is that we're all already hanged. We all have the ropes all around us.
But we have sharp knives too.
We have sharp knives. Yeah.
the other thing about Tiller is, now we can go back to the book. But the thing about Tiller is that, you know, as in all your books, and because of who you are, and the same is true of me, is that Tiller is 1/8 Asian. So in today's world, what does it mean to be 1/8 anything? And why is it important to be 1/8 of anything?
Yeah, I absolutely wanted him to be almost something. Almost wholly something, right? And the idea was that, particularly in the town he grows up in, you know, prosperous, pretty white town, a suburban town, that he would pass and that no one would really notice him. You know, he's basically someone who goes under the radar in every way, even to himself. But I did want him to have just a little bit of difference, enough so that he would be conscious of it and maybe curious about it. where he, you know, he has this legacy from his mother, who he doesn't really talk about her Asianness that much, because it's frankly not that important to him at the start of the book. But one of the ways in which he's, you know, enraptured by Pong is the fact of Pong's Asianness. And, you know, it's no mistake, it's no accident in the novel that they go to Asia rather than to Europe, right? You know, they're gonna, and that all of Pong's associates are Asian too. You know, Tiller is just beginning, you know, unlike some of my other books where people, some of the characters are really wrestling more directly with their identity and maybe further along in their considerations and reckoning of those things, of those, you know, everything that identity brings. Tiller is really at the start, partly because of his age, partly just because he hasn't thought about it much yet. But I wanted to catch him at the start. So I didn't want to make it the whole novel. This is not a novel about ethnic racial identity primarily, but it's definitely informed by it. And there's a scene in the novel in which he talks about a friend of his an Asian friend who goes skiing and is ski goggled and masked up, and this nice old white couple, you know, kind of makes an ethnic slur against Asians, not knowing that he's Asian. And I felt that was a kind of metaphor for Tiller and how he's going around in the world. That he feels it inside, but that no one really recognizes it or cares.
It was funny when I grew up in just outside of Philadelphia. My high school was 80% Jewish, and I'm Jewish. And I thought, yeah, pretty much everybody must be Jewish. Yeah. And then I went to the University of Florida and I went to law school there. And when I got my first job in Florida, they hired me. And every once in a while, I hear them talking about Jewing somebody down or something like this. And, right. And I really didn't understand what the heck does that mean and all that. And so I felt I gave them just enough rope, using rope again, to hang themselves. And then I told them I was Jewish and I realized they never would have hired me. But now I felt bad for them because they were so sorry for all the things they had said in front of me.
Exactly. And maybe even half the time, you know, and I came across that too. You know, they don't even know what that word means. It's just the word that
exactly.
they use.
Yeah.
Right? They don't even know what that means. And really, because they don't know any Jewish people. But that exact thing happened to me all my life. Sometimes, go ahead.
Yeah, and stereotypes are a pain in the butt because, you know, you say Jew somebody down, that means making a good deal. And I'm going, well, you know, that's not really that bad. It's just, I'm just Shylock. I'm just
Exactly.
Well, so here's something off the wall. So did you didn't register neighborlady.com, did you?
No, I didn't.
You can buy it for $1,995 right now.
No way.
Yeah, you can buy it for $2,000. I was thinking you should buy it. And then all you have is the thing that says enter. And when you click enter, all you see is a swirling vat of mercury.
That'd be great. Why is it so expensive, neighborlady.com? My goodness. I thought these things were $19.
Well, yeah, but try and look for a site for you. Try looking for nativespeaker.com. See if you can find that.
Yeah, it probably is expensive. Yeah,
I know. It's fun. It's like a scavenger hunt looking for domains now. But anyway, yeah, I would give you $100 if you would buy it.
I'll crowdfund that.
Yes, we'll see if you. Yeah, maybe Riverhead would do it. It would be kind of cool. there's so many different things in the book, but I didn't want to not talk about VJ. So why don't we describe him and his meals? Because you know you are a gourmand.
Well, I don't know if I'm gourmand. I'm just a glutton, pretty much. well, he's the son, 8-year-old son of the woman that. Tiller shacks up with after all his travels, and the kid is, you know, kind of a monstrous kid, bordering on sociopathic, but they're homeschooling him, so he's a big handful, and in trying to, you know, figure out what the hell to do with him, they've suddenly discover that he's got this just incredible innate talent for cooking and eating first, but then cooking later. And And it's a, you know, comic way to get into their domestic life for me, because that's the kind of domestic part of the story. But also a way to, you know, think about, you know, how people get into obsessions. You know, there are lots of obsessions in the book, obsessions that lead to a lot of trouble. And maybe this food thing seems like it's going to lead to a lot of trouble, but it ends up leading to other things. It's not the cause of trouble. But I love food, and you know, but in the end, you know, this is not a book about how things taste. I think it's a book about hunger.
Yeah. It's not just VJ, and you know, some of the reviews have even said, "Oh wow, how come there's so much food in here?"
Yeah.
And but it's all, that's why I'm saying it really bugged me, because I was constantly hungry. Like I said, I did make an omelet, because you say it's the simplest and the best, and I realized it won't take me that much time.
Yes. So,
and I did, and I didn't flip it. I did it like one of the cruise ship chefs who just, you know, tip it back and forth. Is that what
right,
you're talking
right.
about?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. That shaking where you just kind of let it go. And I've learned that long ago. And I always tell my daughters, if you really know how to make an omelet, you don't need a spatula. You don't need anything.
Yep.
Lesson in life.
Well, yeah, plus, especially if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you shouldn't be eating anything anyway, it's all because of you. And, you know, you talk about obsessions. I mean, we could go all over the place, but I mean, you know, sometimes people say, oh, thank you for being such a close reader. And I'm going, well, you wrote a really good book, so obviously I should know what happened in it. But yeah, karaoke is the other thing.
Yes.
It is, because do you karaoke?
I've been in lots of karaoke rooms where I am the reluctant singer. And because I'm such a bad singer.
That's what Tiller thought, though.
Yeah, that's what Tiller thought. And, you know, it was my kind of hope that, you know, Tiller's experience in the karaoke room, where he ends up being amazing, is exactly what I always fantasize about, but can never do. I mean, I should really just go away for a year and take some voice lessons and, you know, just practice one song where I can just belt it out, and then I'd be done.
Yeah, I have one. The only song that is in my register for karaoke is Hotel California.
Nice.
And yeah, it's great. It's perfect. And so, but I got my girlfriend this Model 3 Tesla for Christmas, and Elon Musk, being the wacko that he is, it has a karaoke mode. So,
oh wow.
I know. So I got my two daughters in the back seat and put it in karaoke mode, and I sing Hotel California, and they're so humiliated in the back seat and disgusted and embarrassed. I feel bad, but I just can't not do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, we're all shower singers. The question is, Should anybody be in the shower with us?
Yeah, I know. And that's, you know, it's when the drunker you get, the better you sound.
Yeah, yes.
At least to yourself.
At least
and
to yourself.
And that happens in the book too.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Absolutely.
How'd you pick the music, like Caravan and ELO and even Blood, Sweat and Tears? Where'd that come from?
Well, it's because Tiller talks about his mother being the real singer. Oh. And his mother, even though that wasn't her era of music growing up, she was a kind of, you know, classic rock and folk R&B listener. She's a big LP collector in the book, and so that's really where it comes from for the book. For me, it's a, you know, those are things that, you know, I'm a little bit too young to have listened to that in the formative years of youth, like teenagehood, but I've always loved those songs that are, you know, just soulful, maybe a little sentimental, you know, just are about the heart and breaking hearts usually. So those are the songs that I think in karaoke that work best when other people are singing them.
Yeah, and it's like you said about Tiller, you know, you know, not to continue the nautical metaphor, but he is in some sense at the beginning of the book, kind of at the beginning, like an empty vessel. And he gets filled up with these talents. Well, even like, and this really set the book off to me, because it was a really good way to start it off, was the golf game. Because at the beginning of the golf game, Pong had never played golf and Tiller had never caddied. Mm-hmm. Yet they both
figure it out.
Yeah.
They both figure it out. And it's, you know, it's a surprise to Tiller, and they have fun. And I think that's what I wanted to have Tiller engage with, which is he's trying stuff and lo and behold, hey, it turned out okay. Hey, I actually have a little talent at it. Hey, you know, and this is something that we all kind of hope, right? That we somehow we have these hidden capacities. We have these potential talents that I know, and we all know because we know what of neurology and the amazing capacity of the human brain. We do have those things. It's just, we just need to be introduced. We need a hero to lead us through or to show us the way, you know, sing the tune with us.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, it's also like that movie Sliding Doors or any of those situations where, you know, he just happened to be in exactly the right spot at the right time. Otherwise, his life,
yes,
this book wouldn't exist, yeah, other than that invitation to do what that job.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. And yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, there's nothing you can do about it. That's exactly what life is, every single nanosecond of it.
Well, circumstance, right?
Yeah.
Circumstance, the meeting. And I think about, you know, I dedicate this book to my teachers. And I couldn't pick just one. I mean, I've had so many teachers that, without whom, and librarians, other kinds of teachers, who without whom, I don't know where I'd be. I mean, it scares me to think about where I'd be without certain people saying things to me at certain points in my life or showing me something.
I know. Sometimes I feel like, okay, you know, I've had this life. I'm an old white man now. And all I'm doing is having this bookstore. And then I realize, you know, what better thing could I have in my life? What could I do better than being a bookseller? And I think about it, and there really, I can't think of anything. Like this 12-year-old kid came into my store, and he comes to the counter with a copy of War and Peace. And I can't charge him for that. Why would I make him pay me? Why would I make him pay me?
Well, that's wonderful, right? I mean, I mean, the fact that a 12-year-old kid's in a bookstore and not just on his device. First of all, amazing. You should have hugged the kid. But and you did. You did by giving him War and Peace.
I actually went back and got him another Russian author and brought it back. Gave that to him too. But that's the thing. That's the thing about, and it happened to you and it happened to me. It's like I've never actually even hired anyone at the bookstore. They kind of just fall in. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They just kind of fall into the store, and then 5 years later, there they are.
Well, that's how we get into a lot of things, you know, and even jobs we don't like, but that teaches something. I've learned a lot from the shit jobs I've had in my life.
Me too.
I was a dishwasher, and, you know, Tiller's a dishwasher, and I hated that job when I had it, but looking back on it, so many interesting things happened in that summer of washing dishes.
Yeah, and it's like you were saying about 12-year-olds now, or say buying a TV now. If it doesn't work, what are you going to do? Call the TV repairman and have mm-hmm. them come and say, no, you throw it away and buy another one. It's like, right. But think about when you were younger and you had to save up in the old day for a TV. Like my then wife and I saved for a year to buy a TV for $306. But that TV was so much more valuable to us
than anything else. Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Exactly.
It's funny where value lies, but which goes to another part of the book, which goes to, I guess, the opposite of, and again, without trying to get too close to anything, the concept of betrayal, the concept of lies, the concept of something that you thought was something turns into something else. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's so many handles in this book, aren't there?
There are, you know, and it's a book that, and this is part of what I would consider the education of Tiller. right? It's the going out in the world is not just experiencing. It's not just, you know, highs and lows. Some of those things and a lot of those things are activated and authored, unfortunately, by those we care about and love or trust. And that's one of the things where he's a neophyte, he's a debutante, but like all neophytes and debutantes, there is a moment where you think, wait a second, maybe this person doesn't have my best interest in mind. Maybe there is evil in the world, or, you know, malign intent. And that's something that is really hard to deal with. Because, you know, I think I try to write Tiller and I try to go out in the world thinking everyone is essentially good. You know, everyone is essentially not trying to screw me. But that's part of our, I guess, you know, the way we've made things, just because we're human.
I think it's better to live a life where you trust people and get screwed once in a while rather than just not ever trusting anybody. Don't you?
Right. Right. Absolutely. And the people who feel like they're going to get screwed all the time end up the people who screw other people all the time because they just want to get the first shot in. Right.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
That, like, the whole thing's a duel and that's not it. Right.
And that's been our country for the past 4 years or
yes,
whatever.
Yes, absolutely.
I don't want to start. Don't start me on that. No. Well, yeah. When you talk about him being a debutante, the closest he is to a debutante in this book, almost a debutante who's been roofied, is with Constance.
Yes. Yeah. Oh boy.
You can't be embarrassed by your own book. You have to tell us about her.
Well, you know, he encounters the daughter of this very wealthy businessman, and she's very attractive to him, and it turns out that he's even more attractive to her. He doesn't know it, and he gets into he ends up being the subject of an arcane sexual practice that I didn't know about. People always ask me, well, you know, what kind of research do you do for the book? And I say, I did not research this part of the book personally. But again, I wanted him to, you know, Tiller to, you know, he has a good attitude, right? He wants to, he's attracted to this young woman, but it turns out this woman has her own, you know, agenda too, as people do.
She introduces
him to something that, as he says afterwards, when do you know when you've gone too far? But I hope it's not just comic and awful, but also a way for him to realize, hey, this was traumatic, but you know what? On the other side, I'm still alive. I'm still okay. And maybe, as he says, maybe it wasn't so bad.
You know? Well, I was going to say that, but I'd rather have you say it. Well, the thing is, if we're trying to sell your book here today, that's going to do better selling it than anything we've talked about. Once you say something, an arcane sexual practice that you didn't know about and I didn't know about, everybody is going to buy this book, right?
Yeah, you'll have to look it up. Have the internet ready.
Well, the word is such. Oh, it's a nautical word too.
Yes, it is. It is a nautical word.
I didn't even think about that.
It's a nautical word. Well, they are plumbing the depths.
But yeah, well, okay. If you think of that as being, okay. I'm not going to do any spoilers. But would you like to talk about mortars and pestles?
Yes. Well. There's, as you mentioned, there's an interest in food and food making in this book. And as I did with, as I felt right from the beginning, I knew that this book would be a steady, a steady escalation. So if in the first part of the book, you know, Vij, as I call him, is making, you know, gourmet little items, I knew that Tiller would end up having to make some food himself, but in a different way, in a way writ large, in ways that were horrifying. And so there's this you know, kind of crazy chef he meets who has a lot of power over him. And the chef has his own business where he's making curries. And essentially, you know, he enslaves Tiller to be his mode of production. And he has this, you know, kind of Marxist art ideology. And I think he's trying to teach Tiller, you know, this is another opportunity for Tiller to learn another lesson about economics and capitalism and the modes of production.
Well, it's also the other interesting, yeah, you could really go down the rabbit hole with the book, because, you know, I was thinking about Pruitt, right?
Pruitt? Yes,
Pruitt. Yeah, who assumes who assumes that Tiller is being groomed as his successor. He's an interesting character too. It's like something out of The Count of Monte Cristo or something.
Yes. I love, you know, he was the character that maybe I had most fun with. You know, I'd encountered, you know, we'd all know about the story of, you know, Western guy goes to Asia, goes to teach English, you know, backpacks all over the place, as he's accused by his boss Chili's, the crazy chef, you know, that the soft imperialism of, you know, a guy in $100 Tevas teaching English, betting local women, and so supposedly supporting the local economy. But I want to have, you know, as with other parts of the book, have fun with some, you know, tropes about Westerners and Easterners and where people end up. But I hope in a way that doesn't completely grind him to nothing. You know, he's got a lot of goodness too. But he's subject. I wanted him to be subject to, you know, the full, I suppose, implications of his traveling. and the fact that he's made a new life in Asia, even if it's not of his own making, maybe it's something he can accept.
You know, when we talk about all these different aspects of it, you know, it always goes to the reviews are all going to say genre bending or something like that. And so, not that I ever do it anyway, but if someone asks you, or they will review it and say it's genre bending, what genre would you say this book is?
Oh gosh, it's,
you know, I said picaresque, and you kind of alluded to that, but
yes, it's, well, I think it's many. I really do think it's many books. It's all the books that I wanted to write at the moment, which is, it's a picaresque novel. It's a coming of age novel. It's a midlife crisis novel. It's a sensualist novel, a novel about aesthetics. It's also not quite a realistic novel. You know, it starts out to be like a realistic novel, but then it becomes a sort of absurdist novel. So I don't know what it is, but someone else I was talking to said that it felt like you were juggling all these balls in the air. And I said, yeah. And you know, what I kept doing was adding balls. And at some point, you know, as the juggler, there's none of them are in his hand. And I felt like, maybe that's the same thing with the genres in this book. You know, it's like I had maybe 20 different little genres all mixing up.
Well, it's not giving anything away, but if you think about it, you know, in the beginning I thought, oh, I wonder if this is going to go like into the realm of magical realism or something like that. And then I realized it didn't. But then if you think of Sharp Knives, which we've been talking about all morning, you know, like, there it is. You know what I mean?
Yes. There it is. Yes.
So it's almost like, why, how, you know, it did, because you don't have him. I won't go there, but you know what I mean, right? You don't.
Well, I think maybe the way that I would describe it if I had to as a reader is, I make you think that you're comfortable in this genre, and then suddenly it's not quite that genre. And then you think, oh, no, it's this genre. And then it's not quite comfortable in the genre. And I've always been an interested genre reader. In my first book, I talk about that. And more genre as it has to do with his personal identity. But the kinds of people we are, ethnically, sexually, you know, racially. But in this book, it's definitely a book that talks more about kinds of storytelling and kinds of characters. And it's also an immigrant. This is also an immigrant novel, right?
Yeah. Yes, it definitely is.
It's also a Striver, American Striver novel.
Have you ever met anyone like Pong?
Yes. And
that, so have I.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Both, you know, East Asian and South Asian people a lot in when I was living in Jersey, and absolutely the inspiration for Pong.
We're on the Jersey Shore. What beach are you talking about in the book?
No, not Jersey Shore. I lived in Princeton.
Yeah, I know. But when you allude to the Jersey
Shore. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, more like Barnegat and, okay. Over there.
Yeah, because we have a house in Stone Harbor. You know, we're Stone Harbor, Avalon.
Yeah. More south, I guess.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, because, you know, in your reviews, are, you know, everyone's always going to say Asian. But when we're talking about handles, it just so happens that that's what you naturally gravitate. Just like the story I told you about me becoming an attorney. You know what I mean?
And that's what people sometimes forget, you know, that it's, you know, this is what I tell my writing students is like, don't force anything. Don't feel like you have to write about anything. If you write about your life and you happen to be an Asian immigrant, all those things will come into it to the extent that you're interested. They can't help but be, you know, that be included. If you're not interested, if you're an Asian immigrant, you're interested in Victorian literature and Edith Wharton, great. That's what will come into it. And you'll turn the story in an interesting way. You know, be yourself rather than be what you think other people expect you to be.
I don't want to write a book like Ethan Frome.
Yeah, exactly.
Although that has as dramatic an ending as your book for sure.
Yes. All these books. You know, it's funny because people always ask me about my reading education, and I was you know educated in all the whole Western canon, right, from the classics to, you know, Victorian literature, Edwardian literature, postmodernism, everything. And I do remember, you know, say reading, you know, a Henry James novel or Edith Wharton novel or an English novel and thinking, you know, at the time, like, gosh, why am I reading about all these privileged white people who are just trying to get laid or not trying to get laid? Basically, it was all about that to me. And sometimes I just throw the book across it. You know, I admired the prose, but I just kind of, you know, wanted to chuck the book against the wall. but of course, you know, I learned a lot from those books too.
both of us cherish books, and obviously I do as a bookseller and you do as what you just described. But have you ever hated a book so much that you actually did throw it across the room or out the window? I've done it like 5 times, I think.
Yeah, I kind of do that sometimes, you know, just because I guess I have so much hope for every book that I get disappointed. I'd never say anything to the writer, you know, but, you know, and I won't mention the books, but they're books that aren't necessarily so bad. They're books actually that disappoint me because they could almost have been good. It's funny.
That's really interesting.
And that, in fact, like almost a good book that ends up being really ordinary. And somehow that depresses me and makes me sad.
Well, and look, the book made you feel. So, I mean,
That's true.
But yeah, you're right. It's always the ending too, where you think, oh, it's either a deadline or she or he didn't want to do something. But it's not the ending that actually your book, and I'm not going to spoil anything, but your book at the end with regard to the smartest guy in the book, it ends in such a way, it's almost like a Marvel comic. Like you think, oh, I wonder if there's going to be a sequel to this. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah. 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 And I won't ever write sequels. I don't like to do that. People have asked me all the time, but I did want to leave off so that especially in this book, you know, about heroes, about people who exist. You can't kill them off, not fully. You can't. You just can't. It's just cruel.
I know. It's like Moriarty.
Yeah, exactly. So I want his specter to be always there, because it is always there for Tiller. It's absolutely always there.
Oh yeah, like we were talking about meeting someone like Pong. It's like when you meet these people, and generally in my life, I can count them on the fingers of one hand. There is something about them. There's either a light, or you can use the cliche, like there's an old soul or something like that. But it's just like everything falls into place in their life, but with apparently no effort on their part.
Exactly. And that's something that's their magic.
Yeah.
And you don't encounter that kind of magic very often.
And once
you see it, you can't let it go. You really never. Just can't. Yeah.
Well, that's a good spot to stop, I guess.
Yeah. That's a great spot.
Yeah. So thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you. I kind of wish it was video, but that's fine. But I mean, you know, just because it was fun talking to you, I don't know. And then you've been seeing me for an hour and I haven't seen you.
Sorry. I try not to do that as much as possible. So.
Nah, I understand completely.
Yeah. But thank you. Thanks so much. It was a fun conversation, which, you know, isn't always. So.
I understand. Yeah, sometimes it's just, hey, could you tell us about your book?
Right.
That's all you get.
Exactly.
Okay, so Chang Rui, thanks so much for being with us here today, and I really enjoyed talking to you.
Okay, great. Good luck with the store, and good luck with that 12-year-old. I hope we'll be hearing from that kid someday.
I'm sure we will.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.